Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Belated Happy New Year to everyone, though the holidays are something of a distant memory now on the first day of classes here at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined again by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy return.
Yeah, you know.
Campus.
I'm feeling good. Spring.
You seem very, you know, perky in our morning teaching assistant meeting.
I appreciate that.
You know?
I don't get described as perky very
perky
often.
Perky is maybe not exactly the word I meant, but still, not bad.
It's keeping in line with your hyperbole.
Yes, my slight hyperbole in that meeting. I remember using it, but now I can't remember what it was. We're back. You know, maybe you'll see this on video. Maybe you won't. We're doing a field test with video, which we've experimented with a little bit in the past. If you don't see us, then you'll know the experimentation continues. So for today, you know, we put a poll in the field right before the holiday break and released the data last Friday on the 9th in something of a soft launch.
Yeah.
In so much as we didn't advance it much, and it was a Friday.
We weren't dumping it. It wasn't a Friday news dump,
which I think actually doesn't. If you know what you're doing, I don't think Friday news dumps exist anymore,
right.
But we'll see. But we'll table the timing of the poll and the data collection just for a moment, circle back to it before we wind up. Now, overall, we were looking to take some year-end readings to get a sense of public opinion in the state as we go into an election year. And, you know, if you listen to this, the election year is really just a calendar conceit. People have been talking about the election for better part of a year, really.
I mean, do you ever feel like you're losing it? Because sometimes I do, where I'm just like, wait a minute, where are we actually in the cycle? Sometimes I'm having these conversations. I know everybody knows this, but these conversations keep getting pushed further and further back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just a point, you're just like, wait, when does the campaign start for real? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and we, you know, we've kind of engaged in terms of, you know, when is early, when is mid early for whom, et cetera, et cetera. You know, be that as it may, December, you know, one of the things we wanted to do with this poll was to begin to get some sense of where we were in a conscious way with the year ending and the calendar election year actually starting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as well as has been our habit with these December polls, to check in on a few general things that are a little outside of the usual ambit of our focus on state politics and matters that are more or less right in front of us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things that we just think we ought to be tracking. Though by some happenstance, we did wind up asking some things that wound up plugging into some recent events, and we'll circle around to that. Now, before we get to that, in the rollout post, we led with the ways in which concerns about healthcare prices popped up kind of all over the poll, or at least where we asked about them, they really moved the needle, I guess, is the way that I would put that. So, you know, let's start with how concern about healthcare prices moved up in our battery of economic concerns battery. So why don't you get us started with that, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking a lot about economic views, and one of the things that we generally do is we dig into that by asking Texas voters about their level of concern about, I would say, relatively large or, you know, kind of somewhat exhaustive list of potential economic concerns they might have, ranging from, like, you know, obviously the price of, like, food and consumer goods. We talked about the cost of housing, but also, like, the impact of AI, the federal budget deficit. I mean, we really try to be as complete as possible so as to match, you know, as it comes along, the developing understanding of these issues as people see them. And for much of the, you know, last couple of years, the real kind of winner has been, in terms of concern, has been prices, right? Prices of food and consumer goods, cost of housing in particular. But what we've noticed is in the last few polls, in particular in this most recent poll, the cost of healthcare jumped up a bit, right? And so even back in August, or actually let's go back a year, sort of, you know, last year, you know, we were looking about 60% of people were very concerned about the cost of healthcare. Now, look, that's still very high. It wasn't as high as the cost of like everyday consumer goods, which was closer to 67-70%. But now people's concerns about sort of everyday consumer goods has dropped a little bit. It's still very high. It's still 63% of Texans very concerned about the cost of food. But the cost of healthcare is now the winner. It's 67%. More than two-thirds of Texans say they're very concerned about the cost of healthcare. Not somewhat concerned, that's 22%. Only 10% of Texans said they were not too concerned or not at all concerned, which is actually another way that we haven't really thought about putting this. So 1 in 10 Texans say they don't really have much concern about healthcare costs, but two-thirds are very concerned.
Right.
So, again, it's been growing. It's been on the uptick. In the last couple of polls, we've really seen it kind of take center stage as the leading economic concern amongst a pretty robust battery.
Right. Yeah, and I don't want to repeat too much of what we talked about. I mean, we've been flagging this as it's, again, not to overuse the word, as it's percolated for a while.
Yeah.
You know, we hit it in our year-ending podcast, mm-hmm. I think, when we talked about trends and data and kind of things that we saw happening during the year. And certainly there were some proximate factors in this
absolutely
poking up in December. I mean, obviously, the centrality of reduced ACA subsidies mm-hmm. in the politics of the shutdown. And not to be coy about that, I mean, this was an issue that Democrats pushed pretty hard and wanted really, I think, to define the shutdown in the public view. So, you know, they had a lot to work with here. I think that's the thing that I would pull out of this, at least one thing I would pull out, was that, you know, it's really easy to say, well, it's a Democratic talking point.
Right.
You know, now you're going to be bleeding on at me about affordability, whatever. But it has been in the data.
Yeah.
And to the extent that what we saw during the shutdown and what we saw as part of the Democrats' political strategy, mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't, you know, pull that out of their butts, right?
There was a
foundation for them to think that this was a good political strategy in terms of whatever policy ethical commitments they have. I mean, this is not completely new, but the uptick was noticeable and we saw it elsewhere in the poll, right?
Yeah, that's right. So when we looked at, for example, the performance of state leaders in the legislature, and that's actually how we put it. We sort of said, you know, look, take the sum total of leadership in the state over the last year, number of issues that you know, the voters have told us are important, that elected officials have paid attention to and focused their political capital on. So do you approve or disapprove of how they've handled each of these issues? A very good kind of December year wrap question. When we looked at healthcare, first of all, overall amongst the entire electorate, it was at the bottom. So every other issue we tested, I think we tested a dozen issue areas, every other issue area scored higher. So overall, only 22% of Texans said they approved of the job that state leaders and the legislature had done on healthcare. So only 22%. I can just real quick reminder here. This poll is plurality Republican voters. So this does not have anything to do with the sample. This has to do with the fact that people were dissatisfied. 49%, nearly half, disapproved of the job that the legislature did on healthcare. Now, among Republicans, the numbers were okay. 36% approved, 27% disapproved. But you could almost say that's almost, you know, I mean, it's not an even split, but not great, right, when you have control of it. Among independents, it was 12 approved, 45 disapproved. Among Democrats, of course, 976. But in general, that's what makes these numbers up. And what you could say is overwhelming disapproval among Democrats, not surprising, pretty consistent disapproval among independents, and at best, tepid support among Republicans, only barely, for the job that the state is doing on healthcare. And to your point, part of the reason, you know, in some ways, again, it's easy to say these were Democratic talking points or whatever, but it's also important to remember that Texas in particular is a state that is very potentially reactive to changes in healthcare costs based on the nature of our population, based on our large uninsured population. And in fact, these subsidies that were allowed to lapse after as the government reopened, if you look at the data and sort of the number of people affected, Texas has the lion's share of the population that is getting these subsidies. So it's not surprising in our numbers to actually, a lot of times you don't see these things happen, but here you should see a direct consequence of this because people have already been concerned about prices throughout the entire year. They've been concerned about their economic situation. And if you think people have a concern about the price of a dozen eggs, well, you know, the difference between, a $1,200 monthly premium and a, you know, $2,000 premium is a pretty big difference for pretty much almost any normal person.
Yeah. For those of you that are multitasking while listening, just to make sure you note, I mean, at one point in the beginning, we were talking about concern about health care.
Right.
In the second, we're talking about approval in the legislature and of state leaders. And that's why we talk about the top and then the bottom. Just, you know, I think the other thing that's interesting to me about this that I think is fair to note and should just say straight off, we, you know, there's nothing conclusive, I don't think, in what we have here to clarify this. But when we ask people more generally about the price of health care, and then we put the question in the context of state of the state, and particular state leaders in the legislature, most of the public discourse around health care during the 2025 legislative session was not around prices.
Right.
Because things like Medicare expansion were dead on arrival for the Republican majority, for the state leadership, not something that, as I recall, popped up in, say, the governor's state of the state address, anything like that. And second, the most prominent healthcare issues, you know, were very different, in fact, than cost, because we saw really most of the healthcare headlines or health headlines, as I recall from the session, really had to do more with like MAHA initiatives, vaccines, nutrition, food labeling, you know, the injection of the kind of what you might call the Trump-Kennedy agenda into the legislative. And, and we talked about that in the context of nationalization of politics. That's a, that's an interesting piece of this.
Yeah.
Now, you know, because when we ask about the general assessment, we're asking in the context of cost.
Right.
When we asked about approval, I don't think we asked about cost. It's just general healthcare policy. How do they, you know, how do they handle healthcare?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's at play here. I don't know exactly what to do with that because I don't, you know, the question is, I don't know what you think. I mean, from the respondent's point of view, not to get too into the weeds, but I guess if you're tuned into this, you're used to this.
Yeah.
You know, is the respondent really thinking about state leaders and the legislature, at least the ones that had an attitude? Or is, you know, and I shouldn't say either or, how much of it is that versus the extent to which these big cost issues and the national framing of the issue is seeping into these evaluations of state legislative leaders?
Yeah, I'd say even for, you know, you could complicate that a little bit further and say, and how much of those, that mix of those considerations are made up of like proximate concerns relative to the current political debate we're having versus more long-term just views and attitudes. Because to your point, as a, you know, as a conservative, you know, Republican voter, I could say, yeah, I dissatisfy because, you know, we're putting too much money into the system.
Right.
Or whatever, right? And there's all these, and this is the thing, healthcare attitudes can get really complex really quickly when you start thinking about issues of quality versus access versus these other things that people might, you know, consider the values that they that they place on healthcare. I think, you know, as you were saying that, I couldn't help but think to myself, the other thing that's sort of in my head, that, again, I'll do the same way, I don't know how to square this with anything. But
yeah, well, just, I don't think we have the, you know.
We don't really know. I mean, it's super, it's.
We can't overinterpret the data, as
we're not going
say.
To, but it is the case that every time we've asked about alternatives to the current system that we have, the private insurance-based system, we do find generally plurality, if not majority support in Texas for an alternative to that system, usually something along the lines of a single-payer system.
Right.
And I know that that's sort of like people can be surprised by that because, well, wait a minute, that doesn't, it's like, yeah, but, you know, most people are dissatisfied with the healthcare system.
And we've gotten that three or four, you know, maybe three, four, four or five
times
didn't
trust
over the space
first
of a decade or 12 years. It's been a little while. I think we had it on the spool and we jumped it.
We've jumped it a couple of times. But the thing is, I would say the first time we saw it, we were like, well, that can't be right. And then we ask again, well, maybe it is. And we ask again, we're like, well, I guess it is. And that's the piece of now. But to your point, just because people, you know, reject the current system doesn't mean that they all agree on what the new system should be or any of these other things. So this is just to say this is complicated. But the other thing I think, you know, the bigger kind of question is like, how does this, I mean, to me, one of the things that I would say is like, this is the sort of issue that I'm, you know, flagging right now. And people say, what are you watching in 2026 in terms of the elections? As we move from, again, the legislature, you know, moving ahead, you know, what are you flagging? And I'd say, I'm flagging these healthcare views. And I'll tell you for, you know, for a couple of reasons. One, we keep seeing it pop up. Two, the nature of the government shutdown and the lapse of the subsidies. And you can already see, you know, the Republican Congress, or not, sorry, yeah, the Republican Congress in the House, mostly Democrats, some Republicans were able to try to pass a bill to extend the subsidies, probably, you know, not going anywhere, but it shows that the moderate Republicans in the Congress right now are worried about this, right? And it's also the case that, you know, the overarching kind of context of this issue is not great. So when we look at, you know, Donald Trump's job approval across a number of different issues, and, you know, he's hanging over these 2026 elections just like he's hanging over the 2018 elections probably. And when we look at the little bit more than a dozen issues that we test job approval for Trump in, we find that healthcare is, again, at the bottom. 52% of Texans disapprove of the job that he's doing on healthcare, 30% approve. You know, once again, among Republicans, not bad, 55 approve, 19 disapprove. But that's, again, very bottom of the list. You know, everything else is much, much higher. Democrats, you can imagine, 6 approve, 88 disapprove. But again, independents, 21% approve, 60% disapprove of his handling of healthcare. And I sort of threw this in at the last minute, but I think it's notable that back in August, when the One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed, one of the discussions then was about healthcare costs. And at that time, 44% of Texans, the plurality, said they expected the One Big Beautiful Bill Act to increase their healthcare costs. And so, or, you know, at best would have no impact. But for the most part, the thought was it was going to increase healthcare costs. That was include 79% of Democrats, about half of independents. And so if you think about, you know, we're going to election year, what have you passed? What do you want to run? If you're a congressperson, you want to say, what did I do? Well, I was in Congress this last session, and you're going to point to them one thing. Well, right now, the plurality, almost the majority of people, at least in Texas, think that that is part of the contributing factor to increasing their healthcare costs. Right. That idea is out there. You can expect the Democrats are going to campaign on that idea again. And so this is just kind of floating out there in a way that is hard to imagine how it's going to get batted away anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think expectations about what Democrats are going to campaign is a good, it's a good transition, but with a one more stop on this, which is, you know, the uncertainty around that.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, if how the if is pretty answerable, I think. Yeah. Democratic candidates are going to incorporate healthcare into their affordability arguments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what that's going to look like. But also the degree to which that is a part of the fight over agenda control as we go into the general election.
Yeah.
Right now. There's going to be a long kind of long pause on that while we get through the primaries, mm-hmm. in which, you know, healthcare will almost certainly be more of an issue in Democratic primaries.
Well, because that's where the Democrats can really burn themselves.
Right, than in Republican primaries. But as we've seen in the last few weeks, there's a lot of things going on that are going to affect that because healthcare is not still, interestingly in all this, healthcare is not moving a lot in the most important problem batteries.
Right.
A little bit, I think, but not in any way that I would go, oh, that I would add this, like, we didn't add that to this discussion.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we can put a pin on that and maybe talk about that a little bit more next week. We talk about agenda management. But if we're going to talk about the poll results, you know, we have to check in on the Senate race.
Yeah.
You know, I may be a little more sick of that than you are, but
no,
not sick of it, but I'm kind of like, you know.
Well.
But I mean, to my mind, I didn't see any dramatic developments here. We can look at some things, and I you know, you've talked about some things mm-hmm. you noticed. So let's talk a little bit about what we saw in the Senate race. Now, since they're always second, we'll just start with the Democrats.
Yeah, why not?
Let them go first, at least in the podcast.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, real quick, you know, we obviously asked about, we asked a number of favorability items on most of the major declared candidates at that point in time. And if we look at, again, the two sort of leading candidates in this race, Jasmine Crockett and James Tallarico, you know, we found looking among Democrats, 70% of Democrats expressed a favorable view of Jasmine Crockett, 49% very favorable. This actually was an increase over the October polling of, I think, about a 6-point jump for her, which is pretty, I mean, I'm gonna be, this is pretty remarkable because she entered, you know, at least very high in terms of name recognition with Democrats, extremely positive relative to other candidates we've seen in a number of years. And so the fact that she was able to kind of do that and then grow it.
Extremely positive and well-known.
And, yeah, extremely positive and well-known. Yeah, it's not uncommon.
Widespread.
Right, exactly. It wouldn't be uncommon to see overwhelmingly positive views, but also significantly more voters without a view. So, for example, Representative Tallarico is viewed favorably by 46% of Democrats and unfavorably by 6%. That's overwhelmingly favorable. It's plus 40 points.
But
there's 49% of Democrats who currently don't have an opinion of him. No opinion at all. They can't say positive or negative. They just say literally they just don't know who this person is.
And you know, look, two things here. I mean, one, I would say he did not gain a lot of ground.
Almost none.
In terms of spreading his name recognition.
No.
Right? Yeah, virtually none, I think.
Since the announcement, really.
Yeah. And, you know, I would pose this as in some ways as a, you know, what do you think? This is also the first time we've been in the field since Allred got out. It's, you know, basically Crockett in, Allred out.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't really seem to have helped Tallarico.
Yeah, I mean...
we're not doing trial ballots,
yeah,
et cetera, but that's what I'm saying. You know, not a bunch of huge change evident here other than, you know, the increase in Crockett. And, you know, we've seen really good fundraising numbers for both of these candidates.
Yeah.
But the Tallarico campaign made a point of saying they had good fundraising numbers again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're there. They're in the race. But a little up, still looking a little uphill as of December.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like a broken record thing, but it's something you always have to remember is, you know, Texas is a really big state. And being, you know, a state representative, you know, even from one of the biggest sort of Democratic areas in the state really is just a jumping off point, but nothing more. And it requires a lot of work from there. The thing about Crockett is that, you know, she's been able to develop, you know, and I'd say to some extent, I hesitate. We're going to use a little slight hyperbole. Again, I'll borrow it from you.
Word of the day. Word of the day.
Slight hyperbole. You know, she's been able to develop something of a national brand among Democrats that is not something that is a given for most candidates. Most, you know, certainly most right. congresspeople, certainly not a state rep. Very rare that even a Senate candidate in a given state sort of kind of has some kind of a national profile. But she's, you know, she's got something of a profile. And you can see that in the numbers here. And so, you know, I mean, I think the thing, the real question, I mean, is we're sitting here now is, you know, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of asking, I'll throw this back, you know, is there enough time and enough money for Tallarico to make this more competitive with her than it looks like it's going to be?
Yeah. I mean, I think if we were to have somebody here that was a, you know, campaign mechanic.
Yeah.
They might say, is he willing to do what it will take to do that?
And that's I'm going to say this.
Not to be overly oblique but you know.
I want to be less oblique about that.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, let me be less oblique because I think it's part of it also goes into the Allred decision here, which is, look, we've talked about this before. The Democratic Party as a party is a majority female party. It's also a majority sort of person of color party, especially in Texas. And we think about where is the plurality of the voters in the Democratic Party here? They are women of color. So the idea of trying to take down Crockett's favorability numbers or increase her unfavorability numbers within the Democratic electorate into a primary is going to be a very touchy activity.
Yeah, it's a trap.
It's a trap, and it's something I'll say, you know, we talked about this, and I'll say this, you know, it's something that certainly Colin Allred was not going to do. There's no future in the Democratic Party of trying to...
And he was very explicit about that when he got out. That was one of the reasons he didn't want to stay in.
He's not going to go in and be, you know, the Democrat, the black male Democrat kneecapping the black female Democrat in a Democratic primary because ultimately he's not going to win that fight, probably. I think he knew that based on the numbers that are everywhere and probably his own numbers. But two, good luck on your next race.
Yeah.
And so, you know, is it better or worse for Tallarico? I don't know. It's not great. And so...
That approach would also walk into... You know, another difficulty that Democratic candidates are navigating right now and that is pretty ripe for Tallarico or pretty present for Tallarico, which is the left-right, you know, or left-of-center, you know, progressive moderate tension within the party. And I don't have it right in front of me, but that is not a resolved issue.
No.
You know, when we look at our poll item on do you think Democratic elected officials in Texas are too liberal enough,
not liberal enough,
you know, that issue is not settled.
No, it's remarkably not settled. I mean, and when you think about it, you know, and like, how could that manifest itself? I mean, just to tie it back, it's like, so what are your approaches to solving healthcare? And honestly, the answer there is going to, you know, it's going to either engage or alienate a lot of voters, depending on how close you want to get to a universal system and govern, you know, all that stuff. And so, you know, this still has a ways to go to say that. But I'd say, you know, having looked at all this and seen the data so far, I mean, it's really remarkable the strong position that Crockett finds herself in.
Yeah.
I mean, given how quick her rise has been, you know, I think Tallarico, honestly, similarly, has had a really remarkable, I don't say rise because he hasn't actually like jumped offices,
but
in terms of his overall profile in the party, he's really, he's earned it. We've seen it over a number of years, the way he's done it here and stuff. So it's not surprising to see him in this position, but this is going to be tough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I think we can, you know, say it's arise fairly enough. Yeah. I mean, is there a state representative in the current Democratic delegation that has numbers like Tallarico? No.
No, because you know what? We actually asked about two other Democrats in the Democratic legislature who are running for other offices, and they're as unknown as you'd expect a Democrat running statewide for the first time to be, and that's in Gina Hinojosa and Sarah Eckhardt. And both of them are largely unknown to Democratic voters, and almost completely unknown to the whole electorate. So,
right. I'm taking a pause to imagine Representative Hinojosa and Senator Eckhardt on Joe Rogan. I don't know.
Together or separately?
Separately. That's quite a conversation. Okay, on that note, so let's talk about the Republican side of the Senate race then. Also a much-discussed race. Also something with, a little bit of movement, but not,
Yeah.
So what do you make of where that's at? So, I mean, to me, it's kind of not, not materially different than what we've seen.
I mean, I'll say this. As someone who studies politics and conducts polls, there was enough movement for me to be satisfied that, like, the efforts of people, like the elected officials and the public, to try to, like, influence attitudes, some of it's going on, just very little, which makes sense. I mean, this should make sense, right? John Cornyn's been around for a long time. Ken Paxton has been around for a long time. Ken Paxton has been in the news a lot. John Cornyn has been in the news a lot. People have attitudes about these guys, and it's unlikely that one campaign ad, one mailer, one robocall is going to all of a sudden... Or even several is going to shift, 10% of the Republican electorate one way or another on people that they generally are pretty familiar with. But we are seeing some movement. And we're seeing a reaffirmation of the challenge that John Cornyn faces here. And so, again, favorability numbers, 38% of Republicans hold a favorable view of John Cornyn, but 27% hold an unfavorable view. So he's plus 11. For Paxton, 50% hold a favorable view. So that's, again, pretty solid. It's 12 points higher than Cornyn. 22% hold an unfavorable view. That's 5 points less than the unfavorable views of Cornyn. Now, I should say there are some changes here. Like, we've been asking this for a while, and ultimately, the numbers were rigid, poll after poll throughout much of this year. This year, we saw Paxton's favorability numbers decline a little, about 5 points. We saw his unfavorables go up about the same amount. The problem for John Cornyn is that the same thing happened to him, just not as much. His favorables went down a little bit among Republicans, his unfavorables went up. And the real thing that I think people are looking, who are looking at this race, is if you look among for example, like conservative voters, 29% hold an unfavorable view of John Cornyn compared to 35% who hold a favorable view. Paxton's numbers among this group relative to Republicans almost unchanged. And this is the challenge: as the electorate becomes more conservative, it becomes smaller. How Cornyn is going to, make this a real race with Paxton, I mean, it may just be getting to a runoff, is going to be challenging. And part of it is, one, he's got to ding Paxton a lot, which I think he's doing. There's some evidence that, it's starting to seek through a little bit. The other thing that I think is sort of, I think everybody just saying this, putting a flag in this kind of for later and for more polling and other stuff that comes along, is like, I think for Cornyn to be effective here, he's going to need to expand the primary electorate. He's going to need to bring in some Republican voters who maybe don't vote in Republican primaries as often. And I'll just say, if he is successful at doing that, that's going to be hard to predict. You're not going to know it's happening until it's happening if he can do it.
Well, given that Paxton's numbers among Republicans are significantly better than Cornyn's, it's not clear to me that even if they do that, to me, the reason I'm kind of feeling like, we can find some movement in the numbers, but the dynamic still seems to be the same,
right?
More or less, which is that for all that you can talk to people that are professional political stakeholders or political professionals, and they're mostly pro-Cornyn in the Republican world, that is not what is going on in the Republican voting base.
Right.
And I don't think that anything that Cornyn has done so far has changed that fundamental baseline. Now, again, I've said on here a million times, we've kind of criticized Cornyn, criticizing the right word. We've commented dryly on Cornyn's lack of popularity.
Yeah.
The cliche I use all the time, we've damned Cornyn with about, the faint praise of Republicans that have reelected him four times, elected him four times and few times before that. early elections aren't really all that relevant to where the Republican Party in Texas is right now. But I'm just not.
Well, I think to your point,
I'm not seeing, you know, what the Cornyn campaign needs. I mean, in the conventional terms, to shake up this race, I don't see this race getting shaken up yet.
Yeah, I think no, not yet for sure. You know, I think the reality is you know, going back, kind of combining what you just said with what I said is, you know, it's not as though something's going to happen where those, you know, the third of conservatives with an unfavorable view of Cornyn just all of a sudden it's like, oh, I was wrong. You know, oh, actually, I do like this guy. I think he's doing great. You know, that stuff is pretty bait because in part is we've been conducting this polling for so long and we've seen this for so long. Now, look, if it's Cornyn against any Democrat, of course they're going to vote for Cornyn. I think the thing that's notable this time is that, you know, I have to think back about Cornyn's previous primaries, but I don't believe he's faced a statewide elected official with this kind. I mean, certainly with this kind of conservative backing. And that's the problem is that, you know, this is someone else that these same voters have probably also voted for before, at least in a general election, if not also in a primary for a different race. And so now this is a real alternative for them. So, I mean, I think the real question, you know, I mean, to honestly, is Cornyn, you know, not willing, but is he able to go so negative on Paxton that he can disqualify him, which I would say is
They're trying pretty hard. I mean, that's been the game plan from day one. It's not like they and their allied groups are pulling their punches.
Right. And that's where, you know, Wesley Hunt is kind of sitting here over on the side saying, hey, guys, you know, I can be that guy. Now, at the same time, Hunt is unknown by 60 plus percent of Republicans, 60 plus percent of conservatives. Again, there's more normal numbers we'd expect. And so he's got a lot of room to go before he becomes an alternative to anything for a lot of people. But I mean, this is like, you know, something really, you know, again, I think Cornyn is going to have to be really effective in carpet bombing Paxton on a bunch of stuff that, you know, anybody who follows Texas politics knows what those things would be. I just don't know if it's going to make a difference at this point or if there's enough time.
I mean, you know, to your point, I mean, those views are, you know, if you go back to our polling a few years ago during the impeachment of Paxton and his trial in the Texas Senate, Republican voters, particularly Republican primary voters, this is not news to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think you were talking about, you know, what, you know, you mentioned, you know, what could they do to shake up this race? I mean, the one thing we do have to mention is the big thing that is out there is the Trump endorsement.
Yeah.
Which it just seems as if in this circumstance, it's unlikely to me that Trump is going to endorse in this race.
Yeah, I don't think so.
It's not the kind of race he's been wanting to jump into. It just doesn't seem as if he and Cornyn have had the relationship that would lead him at the last moment to cut Ken Paxton loose in a way. And he clearly is more simpatico with Paxton than with Cornyn. You know, that said, Cornyn has done some things behind the scenes that are very smart, mainly hiring people that are affiliated with Trump on his campaign team. His pollster, he's hired consultants that are associated with Trump. But I, you know, is that a secret? Could that be the secret weapon that unlocks a Trump endorsement? Or is it just consultants cashing in? Could be both.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing just to that I do want to say in Cornyn's, I don't even think it's, I'm going to put it into this pro column or whatever. It's just like, you know, this guy has been reelected a number of times, and it is the case that as much as, you know, we damn him with faint praise for the numbers. That
we said that a bunch of times on here, and we always come back to this saying, hey, we should acknowledge that he keeps winning.
He keeps winning, and so you know, it seems like he's really up against it. But also, if there's anyone, you know, really honestly on the ballot who, you know, has dealt with this situation and managed it, it's been him. So we'll just have to wait and see. But it is a, you know, it's more like a cul-de-sac than a corridor for him.
Yeah. And look, to your earlier point, it may be that he has not dealt with this situation.
Yeah.
Because he has not had this level of challenge at the primary level.
Right. Another statewide elected official. Yeah.
Okay. Before we run out of time, let's go back and hit a couple other things on the from the poll that, as I said at the beginning, we put some things on here before a couple of big situations developed. So one of the things we did was our battery of something like a dozen or 15 countries that foreign countries. And we've been doing this roughly annually for several years now. And for the last few years, we've done it in December, where we give people a list of countries that are in some ways relevant.
Yeah, I think so.
To U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy, and asked people, just do you have a positive or, you know, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of these countries? Now, we should say before we get into this that there are different ways to do this. You can ask, you consider this an ally or, you know, this country an ally or an adversary of the U.S., et cetera. For various kinds of reasons, we've just gone with favorability. And one of the countries on the list turned out to be Venezuela.
Yes.
So what did we find out from that, you think?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, we found that, you know, negative attitudes towards Venezuela as a baseline are widespread. And it's important. You know, we asked this before any of this happened. And so this is, these are people's sort of standard attitudes towards Venezuela. And Venezuela, I mean, look, we've had many decades of, you know.
It's been a contentious relationship for about the last 15, 20 years.
Right. Yeah. And so it's not totally surprising. You know, Democrats were a lot more ambivalent. You know, 16% had a favorable view of Venezuela, 32% had an unfavorable view, which means, you know, about half had no strong views or any views. Among Republicans, 70% said they had an unfavorable view of Venezuela. Only 7% said they had a favorable view.
And half very unfavorable among
Republicans.
That's right,
50% very unfavorable.
Which is the asterisk there, I think.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So first and foremost, it's kind of like, you know, if you're thinking about the target of these activities and the potential reaction to it, there aren't a lot of, you know, say, friend or foe. Not a lot of people who see Venezuela as a friend, probably, in many cases. Now, at the same time, there's another question that we've been asking for a number of years, actually, many times, about essentially voters' orientation towards U.S. intervention in foreign affairs more broadly.
Just engagement.
Yeah, engagement broadly. It's not necessarily, you know, we're not talking about military, but just engagement with the world.
Well, the question is, you know, agree, disagree, do you think the country would be better off if we stayed out of world affairs?
Right. Just focus inward, right? And in this last poll, what we found was, you know, overall, Texas voters were almost split on this question, which is sort of important, I think, in the broader context here. More importantly, I think, for understanding kind of the Trump administration piece of this, because, again, you have to remember, Trump, you know, I think very overtly campaigned on not getting into foreign conflicts.
Right.
Not
part of America First, quote unquote, was, you know, not engaging in foreign adventures and et cetera,
and that's where the whatever pushback that has come up from the Republican Party has mostly been recently in response to this stuff, and has really been along these lines of, hey, wait a minute, I thought we weren't doing this. And that really reflects a very split Republican electorate. So when we ask Republicans about, you know, whether the country would be better off if we stayed out of world affairs, 52% half agree that we would be better off. That's sort of, you know, America First, whatever, isolationism, whatever you want to call it. But 41% disagreed. You know, the majority of Democrats disagreed with that, just to throw that out there. They're a little bit more, but they were still kind of split. And what I think, to me, my general takeaway from this is just to sort of say, you know, this is actually a very, really, our place in the world right now is very much up for grabs, you know, in terms of what the domestic, you know, sort of forces feel about this. When we look at voters, when we look at the Republican electorate, when we look at the Democratic electorate, it's unclear right now whether people want us to be intervening. You know, we're going to setting aside, you know, this particular intervention and the methods of it and the whys and all that business. But in general, you know, this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out because, you know, again, I don't see a lot of Republican candidates in 2026 talking about the foreign agenda that we're engaging in right now based on these numbers, right? It's not
helpful.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I would add two things to that. One, you know, there's a real historical context here that has to do with the long-term factions in both parties that were, you know, we used to talk about in terms of internationalism versus nationalism, you know, the degree to which the U.S. should be engaged in the world and on what terms. Mm-hmm. And the on what terms is, I think, real important. And, you know, what we've seen with the rise of, you know, to some extent which we could say Trump, but he's not the beginning of this by any means. I mean, this has been a long-term debate, and there was a period, you know, the post-war consensus in the United States wasn't an internationalist consensus. Mm-hmm. There were dissidents in both party. There were the parties. There was the more, you know, the inheritors of what was then known as kind of the isolationist wing of the Republican Party. And then on the progressive side of the Democratic Party, a very vocal anti-interventionist wing. And all of that has changed a bit. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's interesting about Venezuela and the Trump administration's focus on hemispheric politics and a kind of dusting off the Monroe Doctrine is that it does complicate that.
Yeah.
Because you can, the assertion of U.S. influence in the Western Hemisphere taps into other elements of what we might now call MAGA or more revanchist political identity and political forces in the Republican Party. That's a little bit different than staying out of the rest of the world. Now, we can talk about that.
Yeah, you're touching on a lot right there.
You know, we can talk about a lot of different aspects of that, but, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic that I'll be, you know, we'll have to try to figure out a way to find room for in the February poll. Because we need to kind of check in on that a little bit, right? And I'm not, you know, and think about ways to do that. And there are a lot of different ways to do that. So,
yeah, I mean, just to respond to the rhetorical question, we move on, but sort of, you know, it makes me think, you know, it's kind of like, so if we were to ask, you know, where is it more or less appropriate for us to intervene as a country?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that these have been traditionally asked, the kind of foreign policy survey work that I've seen, is to go back to some, you know, away from this favorability thing, but, you know, how important is this to the national interest of the United States?
Yeah.
You know, Europe, Asia, Latin America, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, how, you know, how much does what goes on here impact you?
Right, something, you know, stuff like that. Right, and there's, you know, there's stuff out there. So,
yeah.
Now, the other thing that we included before we close out, and, you know, we'll talk about this very briefly, and an old topic on this podcast, of course. We also asked about the Trump administration's approach to immigration enforcement.
Yes.
And, you know, initially when we were putting this together and putting this poll together effectively in November for December question, maybe I guess we did do this, some of this in December. You know, we were initially curious about this as a contrast to a question that we asked earlier in the first Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And of course, now it's taken on new meaning in the aftermath of, you know, an ICE officer shooting and killing a woman in Minneapolis last week in a confrontation between protesters writ large and ICE officers engaging in enforcement in the Minneapolis suburbs. So let's talk a little bit about this as the setup for immigration going forward. But I think we'll wind up picking this up in more detail next week.
Yeah. So basically, you know, what we asked is, again, same question we asked back in October of 2018 was essentially, you know, do you think the Trump administration has gone too far, been about right, or not gone far enough in its enforcement of federal immigration laws? And again, we asked this before the last few weeks. Overall, in this most recent poll, 45% of Texans said, you know, the administration's gone too far. By far, the plurality response, 25% said it's been about right. 23% said it's not gone far enough. This is one of those results I always think is important to take a step back and remember, you know, you sort of see that 45, we have a graphic, I'm looking at a graphic, you see that 45% bar, you say, well, it's so much bigger than those other two bars. But if you think about what they mean, well, 45% of Texans say the administration's gone too far. 48% think it's been about right or not gone far enough. So that's sort of just sort of floating out there. It's a mixed signal overall. The 45% is 4 points higher than it was back in 2018. But where it's really notable is in 2018, only 9% of Republicans thought the Trump administration had gone too far. In 2025, 9%.
Right.
So the majority of Republicans, the vast majority, about 90%, say that either the approach has been about right or that they've not gone far enough. And it's split between those two views.
And
now,
so it's,
I mean, I should just say, obviously, we asked this before, you know, the last few weeks. I do think that, you know, the nature of what's, you know, what has happened is likely to influence attitudes in some probably serious ways. And I don't want to overstate. I don't think when I say serious, I'm talking, you know, I don't know, 5-10 points maybe in that kind of range. I'm not talking like, you know, 50 point swings here. But I think there is something about the nature of the news and the ICE enforcement that really does something different to this issue, which is especially in Texas. I think we notice this all the time. Immigration border issues are often talked about as sort of like taking place at the border. Like a lot of times if we can isolate it to the border and every problem to the border, it becomes comfortable because it's distant. Once you start, and we know from other questions that we've asked that, you know, who's, you know, who the target of this immigration enforcement is, where it's being carried out, and how does matter to people. We see that in other polling data.
Including Republicans.
Yeah, including Republicans. And so ultimately, you know, once these enforcement efforts are taking place in people's communities and there's these kinds of consequences, we should expect there to be some adjustment to some attitudes. Widespread, I would doubt it.
Yeah.
But
that
some.
Said, that 9% was remarkably identical.
Yeah. For now, but yes.
You know, in that period of time. And even though, you know, we're focused on this most recent incident, it's not as if that has been a great storyline.
No.
You know, or you would, if there was going to be significant change, it's not as if it's been a great storyline.
No.
And the elite signaling, the partisan elite signaling on this is pretty clear. I mean, having watched all the Sunday news shows and a lot of the signaling coming out of the Trump administration, and you know, and it's been loud. You don't have to follow closely to have seen what the messaging is going to be. We'll see how much movement there is, you know, if we ask again. I think the part of the context for this, you know, one of the reasons I wanted it for us to cover it before we get out is that, you know, we've seen the salience of, you know, to your earlier point, border security, immigration shift a little bit as things, you know, became, you know, fewer high profile problems right on the border.
Right.
A definite reduction from all the data in immigration, both legal and illegal, as a result of policy shifts by the current Trump administration. We've seen the salience shift a little bit.
Yeah.
But as we go into a Republican primary and we see people really converge on familiar elite queuing and familiar ideological kind of positions, I'm going to be real curious to see where these numbers go in the new year. And it kind of goes back to tie all this together. You know, as we're talking about things like concern about prices, concern about health care, and how that seems to be rising, viewed problematically and from both a policy and a political view among a decent share of Republicans, there still is this other recourse that is going to be very familiar in the playbook of Republican candidates.
Yeah.
I don't think we see this really coming home. We don't really see this develop or until we get through the primaries.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to be reminded that these attitudes among Republicans are still out there.
Yeah.
Some of their attention has moved to other issues that are not, you know, that they don't have good issue ownership over, like health care. You know, the economy kind of up in the air at this moment. You know, there's incumbency factor, all that. But I think, in terms of the partisan response to what we saw in Minneapolis and what, you know, whatever the aftermath looks like, you know, how much the degree to which ICE and the Trump administration double down on this, hold the line, you know, et cetera, it's going to be an interesting piece of agenda management as we see the general election, as we see the general election campaign unfold. And we should also add, you know, that, you know, late last night and then, you know, yesterday evening as we record this on Monday, Trump administration announced an investigation into Jay Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, if you saw, he came back very directly yesterday evening with a pretty blunt statement that was very old school in its tone and politics, saying, you know, we have done nothing wrong. I have informed everybody. Congress, everybody that needs to be informed about this construction project,
which
has
is funny.
Been informed.
It's ironic, but go ahead.
Yeah, yes, the construction thing. And very directly, I don't know if you saw it, very directly, this is about the fact the administration does not agree with our interest rate policy.
Yeah.
And so how that is all the battle for all that and how Republicans voters respond to that after the primary, I think, is going to be an interesting question, because I think it almost goes without saying that the Trump administration is going to be very comfortable, whether they should be or not, if the election is more about are they their enforcement tactics on immigration rather than the economy?
I think, so one, I totally agree with that, but I want to caveat it because I think you've raised some really interesting points, and we're going to wrap up here very soon, so we won't do
well,
this.
Well, I thought we were wrapping up.
I think we are wrapping up, but I think that's right. So I think the challenge then for Republicans is like the salience of immigration and border security has you know, certainly certainly evaporated. I mean, really evaporated, honestly, in a sense. Having said that, this is an issue that you have to bring up in Republican primaries, and it is, you know, worthwhile with a Republican primary elector to present yourself as being the Trump administration's best partner on immigration. In fact, that is a good, it is a very good general election strategy to say, hey, don't hand the keys back to the Democrats because then you're going to let the immigrants take over and all everything that he's done to deal
they
with this problem.
They want to abolish ICE.
They're going to abolish ICE. They're going to do this. Although I will say ICE is doing almost everything it could possibly do to help support its own abolishment. Just going to throw that out there. It's not going to be through Democrats. It's going to be by actions. But anyway, they get through that. They get through that window of time where they say, hey, we're for it. And then we get to this question again, right? In the general, which is like, hey, okay, we're going to be partners of the Trump administration on immigration enforcement. They're not. But that's where this question is sort of so important in some ways about the how they are enforcing immigration policy and whether people react to it well, because in a general election, you may not want to be the guy or girl on the side of the way that the Trump administration is enforcing immigration if we have more incidents like we've been having over the last weekend. That becomes a problematic position, I think, for anybody in a swingy district. Because I look at this and you can say, like, yeah, you know, there's been movement among Republicans on this issue. You know, almost, you know, 57% said the administration hadn't gone far enough last time in 2018. 30% said it had been about right. Now it's split. So there's more satisfaction. 42% say, hey, this has been about right. What I expected. This is about what's right. The problem is that, you know, what about independents, right? 38% said that they'd gone too far back in 2018. It's 49% now. If we have more incidents like this outside of the partisan universe that they're not getting a reaction to, that's going to go up to 60% at some point. They're going to say, this is too much. If this is kind of something that's going on into the fall, you can't be, then at that point, I think being the candidate on the side of, you know, the pro-immigration enforcement is going to be challenging. It's going to be a more challenging message than it has been, I think, you know. But obviously, yeah. But to your point, still, rather have that battle than say, hey, the economy stinks, we need a change in course.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we'll see how much, I mean, definitely the independent factor, which nationally in congressional swing districts is a deal. I think if that's the battle that's going on nationally.
Yeah.
In Texas,
yeah,
that's going to be pretty good for Republicans.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So on that, thanks for being here. Thanks to our folks here in the studio, help sitting through for our experiment in the world of video, and for all your help as always. Thanks to you all for listening. And again, all of this data that we've talked about on the website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Click on the latest poll page. And we'll delve into some more of this next week, I think, when we come back. We'll be back, as far as I can tell, on our regular podcast schedule. So we'll be rolling out Thursday next week again, late Thursday, and dig into more of this. So thanks, y'all, and we'll be back next week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.